I'd like to bring the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Committee to order. Representative Fabian, you want to move the minutes?
All right, yes, Mr. Chair, I will. I move the minutes.
Into the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are adopted. Members, we're going to hear three bills today. Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Hackbart's, and Representative McFarland's bills. We will not be meeting tomorrow for opportunities to attend the unfortunate funeral for Senator Kubley. Welcome, Representative O'Driscoll, back again. We had heard some about your bill, and evidently you've done some more work. So, members, I'll move House File 1923. Representative O'Driscoll, are you headed to the General Register from here?
That is the next course, the next stop of this bill, yes.
Okay, thank you. That's my motion. Welcome, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Fabian, who actually sat in for me at the time that this bill was first presented to this committee. My father had passed away, so I was unable to attend the committee at that time. And I had taken an opportunity to visit with Representative Fabian, as well as to visit with others who had an interest on this. And we've done some work on the bill since it was last before the committee. And I would direct the committee's attention to the A-12 amendment. And, Mr. Chair, I'd ask that you move the A-12 amendment to 1923 as well, since that is going to be the form that I'd like the bill to be in for discussion today.
Members, I'd like to move the A-12 to incorporate it into House File 1923. Discussion to the A-12. All those in favor of the A-12 say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A-12's adopted. The bill's in the shape you'd like to discuss. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, thank you. When we originally had the bill, we were looking at doing a full repeal of the mandatory tiered water pricing for municipalities of more than 1,000 persons across the state of that had more than 1,000 persons within their corporate limits across the state of Minnesota. Since that time, what we've done is we have modified the bill, and what it does is it encourages communities to employ water conservation and takes away the mandatory tiered water pricing and further defines what are measures to mitigate the use or conservation method. And I would like to also introduce Craig Johnson from the League of Minnesota Cities, who was instrumental in bringing together a number of city organizations as well as the DNR and others to help find the language that all parties involved feel that they can live with that the committee is going to look at today. So, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Johnson, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. Following the initial hearing on this legislation, we had a number of discussions, including some conference calls with a wide range of cities and utilities across the state and with the DNR. And it became apparent there's a number of cities that had already introduced and actually implemented their water conservation rates and definitely did not want the existing structure to go away in statute. They felt that would put a lot of pressure on them to have to go back and redo all their water rates again, which is a fairly time-consuming process. We also had several that had come up with some pretty innovative ways to do things, where they had actually used the conservation rates to help leverage getting additional stormwater work to avoid higher conservation rates and things like that. So it was working pretty well for the cities that had chose to move forward with it. We had a number of other cities that obviously were not ready to do this, thought it would be onerous and could demonstrate significant water conservation without having done a conservation rate to do it. So what we came up with is the language that you see here. It was put together with the cities and with the DNR, and it says that the conservation rate still exists as a requirement, but you have another option. You can use a uniform water rate and demonstrate that other conservation practices are achieving water conservation results, and that would be adequate as well. We also clarified that it's done as part of the water planning process, and that's not a change. That's just comfort language to make it clear that that's where it occurs. And we added clarification on line 2.18 that the conservation rate as it applies to multifamily dwellings must be considered as an individual user. We had confusion on that over the last few years that people thought it applied to all water rates, not just the conservation rate.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Qualm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, you do cover multifamily dwellings, but what about manufactured home parks, trailer parks? They're multi-family areas that in some cases are being hit with the higher rate, and they are definitely, you know, below average water usage. Why is that not included in the bill?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, members, to be frank, we would rather have that entire sentence come out of the bill. We're not trying to get more people to pay less water rates in this bill. We're trying to come up with a way to deal with the conservation rate structure requirements. We happen to address that sentence to just flip the order of the words around to clarify the sentence. We weren't intending to make any changes at all to water rate requirements for multi-user dwellings of any kind. That wasn't the intent.
Representative Kwong.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a problem with the fact that you could hit a multi-family dwelling or park with a higher rate just because they're, you know, living in that area, where if they, on average, were using below the average rate, I don't think they should have a higher penalty. That's just my personal feeling on it.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, how many of your cities had already come into compliance with the requirement?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, DNR can give the exact numbers, but roughly half of the metro area cities that were required to do it by 2010 are in compliance, and about 50 greater Minnesota cities have already implemented this, and we have about another 24, I believe, that are in the process of implementing conservation rates.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Johnson, with the changes in this amendment, encouraging rather than requiring, how do those communities that had already met the requirement feel about the changes that the compromise changes that are proposed?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm looking for the encouraging. It does not change the need to either have a conservation rate structure or demonstrate through a uniform rate structure that conservation demand reductions are being.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I'm looking on page 1.20. I realize that you've got the 2.23 and 2.24, but knowing how things work here, probably in 2 years we'll have somebody come and say they can't do it. It's impossible. We need to change the date again. So I'm looking at 1.20 and 1.21, where you move from employ to encourage.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if you read to the end of that new language, it says encourage water conservation by employing. So it actually keeps employ.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Johnson, you believe that this doesn't weaken the requirement, that we would still have the communities come into compliance?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that all that this bill does and the way it's intended to be drafted, and the DNR agreed that that was its impact, and they are certainly here to answer that themselves, is it gives a second option. You can now use either a tiered conservation rate structure or a uniform rate structure with other conservation measures that you can demonstrate are being successful.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the main issue here is a two-year delay and the impact on the multifamily dwellings.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the main impacts here are giving that second option, which was not under the previous law, and the two-year delay. The multifamily dwellings, we don't believe, is a policy change so much as a clarification of an existing sentence.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, on lines 2.1, 2.2, there is a collaborative process to achieve demand reduction as part of a water supply plan review process. I honestly have no clue about that process. How often does it take place?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Representative Guineas, could you please cite again the lines you were looking at?
2.1, 2.2, right at the top of the page.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dave Luthi. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Ecological and Water Resources, Department of Natural Resources.
Mr. Luthi, go ahead with your testimony. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the water conservation water supply plan is a 10-year process. Every 10 years that we're working with communities to update a water supply plan as part of their conservation plan, and so it's a ongoing process that we will continue to work with cities.
Representative Wagenius.
Okay, then if that only happens every 10 years and folks must implement measures by 2015, that's 3 years from now, how are these consistent if this is how you're coming up with demand reduction measures?
Director Luthi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the water conservation rate structure here was enacted before, and so we have been working with communities that are in a water supply plan update process, and the other trigger is that if they need to drill an additional well or have a permit amendment, is that we bring them into compliance at that point, and because that's part of the language too, and so one way or the other, we will bring them into that conservation process, and then we'll have some time. We encourage that they work with us in advance of an amendment or need to drill a new well so that we have the rate structure and conservation plan in place before they need to have the supply provided so that there's not a delay in their process.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we had the original testimony on this bill, I was dismayed by the lack of knowledge by some of the folks who are running our water supply systems about groundwater and how much is available. The assumption was, well, if DNR permitted it, we have plenty, so not to worry. What can DNR do going forward to educate folks about the supply of groundwater, because it's so uneven across the state?
Mr. Luthi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we are doing a number of things. We're doing the county groundwater atlases that you are aware of to help people understand the geology and their water supplies underneath them. With that process, we also find about how new or old the water is, and it tells us the risk as to contaminants getting into the groundwater. We are doing this water conservation process. As part of the Clean Water Fund, there is additional dollars to help us with groundwater supply management that we are moving forward with what we call groundwater management areas, more in a statewide concept of where we will help users as well as local units of government understand their aquifers and the supplies, and then we will try to tie that into the water conservation plans and the water supply plans and the permitting process so that they understand the limitations of their resource ahead of time. We also have some monitoring that we're trying to increase to understand the level changes in aquifers so that we know what the trends are in advance of problems.
Representative Wagenius.
I hear the things that you have on your plate, but, for example, the atlases won't be completed for 30 years. The monitoring system is woefully inadequate. So you list these things, but they don't meet the problem. So what is it that we are doing to actually get on track? Because we're not on a track for Minnesotans to understand their water resources right now, or their drinking water sources. So what else can we do besides say, well, we'll do what we're already doing, even though it's going to take us 30 years to get it done?
Director Luthi.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, you correctly point out that there's a lot of information we don't know about aquifers around the state, and we continue to need to learn more information. I believe that the Clean Water Fund, if it can continue to help us with these groundwater management areas, we're working on an interagency basis with Department of Ag and Health and PCA and Board of Water and Soil Resources to identify critical areas where we're seeing problems start to occur. And we are trying to focus on those areas, particularly where we see that the trends suggest there might be some problems. And then we need to continue with the funding sources for the things that we've discussed already so that we can continue to learn. Not all places are maximizing their aquifer pumping at this point. There are some areas that clearly are using more so, where we know there are problems, and we're trying to focus on those areas particularly. But we will need to, as we get along the path here, to continue to invest in the knowledge so that we can help people manage those water supplies.
Representative Wagenius.
What I hear is a program that is we're not catching up. We're managing where we see problems. We're not anticipating the problems before they become fairly apparent. We are only in a reactive mode. And I don't know how this committee gets folks in a... So we are actually being able to tell Minnesotans that there will be groundwater for your children to drink. There will be groundwater for your grandchildren to drink. I know, I mean, I'm dismayed about the metro area. As far as I know, they still are only planning to 2050, so a kid born today will have no idea whether they're going to have groundwater for the rest of their life. We have not paid enough attention to this. Are you working with Metro Council to say you've got to have a sustainable water plan rather than a water plan that looks till 2050?
Director Luthy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, we are working with Met Council as well. I recognize that we are behind in our understanding of these systems. I think that we're moving as quickly as we can. Clearly, the Met Council has plans for 2030, 2050. We need to have communities, we need to have the general public and our counties understand their aquifers and how to manage them to protect them from quantity and quality. We just need to continue to make investments. We are aware of the problems. As long as this body and the Senate can continue to support that, we will bring about the information and help people understand and use it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I appreciate the coming forward with a second option here, but just trying to understand, if a city chooses to use the conservation program option, what happens a couple of years down the road if a major food processing plant locates in their city? How would they ramp up water usage and yet comply with their conservation plan?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, that is a very good question. Since we've started working on the amendment language on this, I've been approached by a number of large water users who do use it for commercial purposes. Some of them might be the hospitality industry, others might be the food processing or the canning of soft drinks and things here in the state of Minnesota. They are concerned about the tiered pricing. They had actually said that they would consider using, if possible, outside of Minnesota sources because of something of this nature. So our mission is to be able to modify this so that communities can work with some of those large users on their global needs within the community, not only for job preservation or job growth, but as well as meeting some of the environmental and conservation methods and mechanisms as well. And that's why taking away the mandatory and putting other types of things in place. For example, a hotel that I spoke to when I had a chance to visit with them, they said, we economically have no choice but to implement water reduction measures. Matter of fact, they had an audit done by the city to find out if perhaps they had leaks in their systems and different kinds of things because they had seen an increase in water use at their facility because they have a number of swimming pools. So they've gone and they retrofitted their shower heads to low water volume, the same thing with their faucets, same thing in their laundry facilities and their dishwashing facilities because they saw it not only as a good thing to do economically but a good thing to do environmentally as well.
Follow-up, Representative Anderson. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, thanks for the bill. This first came to my attention, obviously, in Thief River Falls. We have a turkey processing plant, and it's like there's two forces working against each other. You have certain requirements in place for making sure that you do provide a sanitary environment to do the processing and so forth, which requires a significant amount of water. And then you have another force that's working against that to try to conserve water. Not that they don't, because obviously they want to take a look at their bottom line as well. But this is a good bill. It frees up, you know, the ability of the city and so forth to work with the processor, and thank you for bringing it forward.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up a little bit on what Representative Wagenius was talking about in the need for conservation and sustainability, and with sensitivity to the issues that we have industry that may need to use large volumes of water. But I do believe it's a little bit of a red herring when industry says they're going to go somewhere else because they don't want to come to Minnesota. I just want to touch on that briefly. We've got water, and they can't go to South Dakota. Probably can't go to North Dakota. Maybe go to Wisconsin. But you get in the Great Lakes, and there's a compact in the Great Lakes about the use of water. So folks are really, the surrounding states are really focusing in on water conservation, and rightfully so. I wanted to ask the gentleman a question, if he would come up here. Regarding, if you tell me your name again.
Director Luthy.
Director Luthy. Do we have sustainability? Maybe you answered this question. Do we have sustainability management at this time for Minnesota waters?
Director.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Purcell, I don't believe we do. We have quantity and quality problems that continue to emerge. We need to continue to invest time and energy to understand how we're using the water, how we're managing the land so that we can protect the water supplies. We have lots of water in this state that flows out. We're in a hurry to get it out of the state as fast as possible at times. If we treat it, slow it down, and enable it to filter and go back into the aquifers in a clean manner, we will have supplies. And so we are blessed with lots of water. If we take care of it well and manage it well, we should be able to be sustainable. We're not there yet.
Representative Purcell.
He just said what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Driscoll, final comments.
Mr. Chair, I think that the comments that I made in my opening statement, that we have worked with the DNR and with the cities to try to find a happy medium to be able to move forward a lot of interests on this, some economic, some administrative, as well as environmental and conservation. I think that we are on a path with this bill, and I would encourage the committee to support this.
Thank you. I'll renew my motion to move House File 1923 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The bill's passed and on to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Hackbart, you have House File 1989. It's the electrical transmission bill. Is there any testifiers that were accompanying this? Representative Hackbart alone, Ms. Sipko? Let's see. Let's give them a chance here before we. You know what, Representative McFarland, we're going to go with you. Why don't you go ahead and come down, and if you would come forward. Members, we're going to do House File 2207. We're going to go with McFarland. Representative McFarland, if you could come forward. Representative Fabian, do you want to move House File 2207? It's the Boundary Waters Exchange bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move House File 2207.
Representative McFarland, are you onto the General Register from here?
I'd like to be once I remove.
Okay. Representative Fabian moves House File 2207 to pass and onto the General Register. Welcome, Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2207 will provide an expedited exchange, condemnation, and private sale of certain state land in the Boundary Water Canoe Area wilderness. And I'm coming to you as the chair of the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee. We have been charged in statute to review the policies of the Department of Natural Resources and current statutes on management of school trust fund lands at least annually, and shall recommend the necessary changes in statutes, policy, and implementation in order to ensure provident utilization of the permanent school fund lands. And with that, on December 9th, we had a motion that passed unanimously, and I will read it. that the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee recommend and endorse efforts by the Minnesota Legislature and the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to proceed and execute the proposed land exchange and sale, land sale with the United States government, and that the DNR is recommended to execute either a land swap or land sale exclusive of the other. And so with that, it would probably be best. Oh, I do, would like to get this in the order that I'd like, if I could. I have a verbal amendment, if I could.
Representative McFarland, you have an oral amendment, you
yes,
said?
Yes.
Go ahead and state your oral amendment.
On page 4, I would like to delete section 4. And I'd like Mr. Meyer from the DNR to explain that.
Let's first, Representative Fabian moves to delete section 4 of the bill at the author's request. Mr. Meyer, to the deletion of section 4.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And I don't know if you've seen the fiscal note or not, but the fiscal note outlines the cost of the entire project at about $1.3 million. That includes a lot of parcel-by-parcel appraisals, a lot of activity, legal transactions, things like that, and that's going to take years to do. Hopefully not years, but it'll take several years anyway. The appropriation language that we're deleting will need to address once this gets traction at the federal level as well. In the short term, we have an appropriation standing within the biennial budget that allows us, it's $200,000, to do land exchanges, expedited activities to benefit the trust. So our intention would be to use small pieces of that appropriation to do the work we need to do until the full-blown process begins at the federal level. So that's the intention there. We will be coming back next biennium with a budget proposal that will address that and reflect that, but those dollars won't be needed immediately is the point I'm trying to make, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, does that completely eliminate the fiscal note then? The fiscal note is zero with the deletion of Section 4?
Mr. Chairman, I will update that fiscal note to reflect that.
Mr. Meyer, does that mean it? I see Ms. Lewis nodding yes. That I need that on the record because then
yes.
It's not. Thank you.
Our costs will be needed to address, but not immediately.
Okay, then the bill won't be going to Ways and Means. Representative Fabian moves to delete section. Representative Quam, to this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is land trust, school trust land that's involved here, and wasn't there already a process by the DNR to catalog and appraise and understand that land? So I thought this was already a process that they were involved in, at least part of this activity, and therefore I support that we're getting rid of this, but I'm just trying to understand, is this duplicative to something we've already had described to us?
Okay, Representative Quam, we're going to vote on the Fabian motion to delete Section 4, and then we will go to answering Representative Quam's question. All those in favor of the motion, the amendment to delete Section 4, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment to delete Section 4 is adopted. To Representative Quam's question.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if it would be better for our testifiers to first kind of tell the history, because I think that would probably answer the questions.
All right, that sounds good. Go ahead, and then that will give the history. I think that's basically what Representative Quam's question was, to understand the history.
If we
Representative McFarland.
If we could, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Bob Krebs, who is a member of the Permanent School Fund Advisory Committee, comment first.
Commissioner, if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robert Krebs. I'm a resident of St. Louis County. I am the land commissioner for St. Louis County, but I'm not here representing them today. I am a member of the Permanent School Trust Fund Committee, and I'm here today to provide a little testimony in regarding House File 2207. This bill, introduced by Representative McFarland and others, serves to set a stage for a process. This is a process bill, in my opinion. It's not identifying any lands. It's not being specific to any particular parcel. I guess just looking a little bit towards the history on this, and to answer the question, a little bit of the question that was asked, There has been some work done at identifying lands outside of the boundary water to exchange for the school trust lands within. We have not, that effort did not try to pair up and match up any properties inside the wilderness with similar type properties outside. The effort was only to identify federal parcels that would be available and you know, and usable by the state in exchange. I guess in looking a little bit at the history of this, as you're aware or may not be aware, the 86,000 plus acres of school trust land and other miscellaneous state lands, tax forfeited trust, and university trust lands are inside the wilderness. The 86,000 acres of school trust land that are the, you know, that are, is our children's heritage, if you will, have been unusable for approximately 40 years, ever since the Wilderness Act declared the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness a wilderness area. This is an injustice that's been recognized, you know, for 40 years, but it hasn't been solved. And the federal government would have preferred early in the process to just buy the land. You know, certainly there was opposition to that, and I would agree with that. So there's been a couple of attempts over the years to resolve this issue, but never got any legs. The Permanent School Trust Fund Committee in 2008-2009 came to the legislature with a proposal to develop a hybrid, part sale, part exchange. You, the legislature, authorized the Permanent School Trust Fund to continue to pursue that. A committee did do that. The committee was made up of mining and timber, Forest Service individuals, education representatives, Permanent School Trust Fund members. And we did due diligence. We have brought a proposal forward. That proposal is not on the table today. This legislation, in my read, is the enabling process type legislation that we need to proceed forward to accomplish some resolution of this. And I would encourage each of you to look at this bill seriously, for and on behalf of the children of the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Meyer, additional comments at this time?
Mr. Chairman, members, just briefly, I think Mr. Krebs did a great job of describing the advisory group. There were also environmental people representing at the group as well, just for the record. This is the nuts and bolts of what needs to take place now that we have this. I think it's about 41,000 potential parcels to transfer. So this is a land exchange activities we're looking to do with the federal government to actually get those parcels into state or federal ownership and the cash payout.
Mr. Meyer, did you say 41,000 parcels, or did you mean 4,100?
Mr. Chair, members, there's 41,000 acres of candidate acres to select from. I believe it's 36,000 is what the total exchange would be. It's a two-thirds, one-third proposal we're looking at doing. This language actually reflects it is what would need to take place to enact the resolution that the legislature passed and sent to Congress in 2010, talking about a hybrid swap buyout to do this. So that's the goal we're going for right now.
Mr. Meyer, you said two-thirds, one-third. Could you clarify which is the two-thirds and the one-third?
The two-thirds cash and one-third land. We're looking for approximately $100 million or more from the federal government, probably in several payments, and then the one-third of land.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, I need some clarification. You said 36,000. That number relates to what again? Because I'm looking at 86,000 acres, roughly,
And if there's 36,000 parcels, I mean, that's not even 3 acres per parcel.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer,
sorry.
That's okay.
I meant acres. I apologize. Right.
Representative Fabian. Keep the thought, Representative Fabian. We can come back to you. Representative, you got more? Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. All of this is being done for the children of Minnesota. So I've been waiting to see the spreadsheet that says that having all of this, the breakdown between swap and cash. I know that if we put cash and put $100 million in the trust fund, we can say as trustees of that fund, the children are well protected because that money is there and we will get interest on it. What I can't see and what I've been expecting to see is a spreadsheet that tells us that we will be able to generate that same amount of money off of the land that's been swapped, and we haven't seen that spreadsheet, and I was expecting to see that today. Can somebody, Mr. Meyer, can you talk about how much money will be generated? We have any idea, or are we just kind of betting that we're going to get an equal amount of money off the land?
Representative Guineas, I could qualify. When you talk about an equal amount of money, you're not talking about the return we're currently getting on the 86,000 acres. You're talking about the return that we could get on the new land as opposed to the money getting cash.
Right.
Because we're currently getting basically zero today.
Right. And Mr. Chairman, I love the idea of getting cash.
Okay. Thank you.
And so I'm hoping, and what I think we need to know as a committee, are we serving the children well when we say part of it is in swap? Is that as good as cash?
And Representative Wagenius, you're talking about cash from the United States federal government that
Absolutely.
Probably will be in the form of an IOU.
Well, I think that they have cash available if they choose to spend it on this. And so the question is, as we advocate, because we're advocating, everybody says this is being done on the behalf of the children, so are the children going to be as well served doing a swap as they are getting cash?
Thank you. Additional Representative McFarland.
Madam Chair, I guess I look at the same point that's been brought up. Are the children being well served now by not getting anything off the lands?
No, that's not the question.
Representative Wagenius.
The question is they're not being well served now. I agree with that. And I totally believe that we should get cash from the federal government. My question is when we go through this process, are we getting, because we're saying we're doing it for the children, I know that if we get cash for this land and then we get fair value and it goes into the fund and we get interest on it, the children are protected. What I don't know, and I expected to see a spreadsheet explaining that over time we would get more money doing a land swap, or at least the same amount of money, because I don't think we want to be just betting that maybe someday we can get more money from a swap.
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Wagenius, the group, the working group, did have a list of criteria that unfortunately I don't have with me. I can send to the committee. A list of criteria that we use to evaluate these swap parcels. Reuniting surface and mineral rights was a big one to avoid any conflict. Looking at timber revenue. There were several other based on revenue generation that we have there, and I do have a list of the number of acres that fall into each of those categories. Now, what we haven't done is a natural resource assessment on these parcels yet, because it's just a proposal that's on the table at this point in time. There's several challenges that we face immediately. One is the lack of a superintendent in Superior National Forest. The superintendent has retired. There's an interim director there, and we're trying to work with them to find out what kind of appetite or temperature they have to get this done. This is a huge priority for the department, for the Trust Fund Advisory Committee, and I think for the state of Minnesota to get revenue off of these lands. So we need to do that natural resource assessment and make sure we are getting the best value for the land.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But we should have some projection now about what we could expect versus asking for all cash. Because maybe we would be better off, since we're doing this for the children, to ask for all cash. And that's the question. And we should have an analysis at this point about what we would expect to get off of lands that have been swapped versus cash.
Representative Deal.
Well, I'm going to try and not turn into Representative Rukavina in this part of the testimony on the
bill.
Well,
you've been pretty patient so far, Representative Deal. You've only kind of waved your hand a little bit. I thought you'd be raising out of your chair. Representative Deal.
Well, I'm trying to be considerate. Section 3 of the bill, I first don't understand, Mr. Meyer, how that this jives with the Constitution. I think it's Article 11, Section 8 of the Constitution, and how we can even have a private sale to anyone, because I was under the impression that only condemnation, public auction, and exchange for lands of equal value are even available to us as options. So Ms. Lewis has come up to answer that. And then secondly is I'd like to know why we've been held to the standard of exchanges only, except for the case of Voyageurs National Park, where there was a condemnation done back in the mid-70s. I believe that was under Governor Anderson, Elmer L. Anderson. And then we were paid cash. But then also, I agree with Representative Wagenius that we should have some kind of a spreadsheet that shows the future potential of the earnings. And I disagree with Representative Wagenius that taking money for any of that land is protecting the kids. Because I sold my core business in 1986. And I have spent since 1986 every single day of my life trying to figure out how to stay ahead of inflation. And when the State Board of Investment can produce nothing more than an inflationary return, at this time at least, over this past number of years, I do not see how that can possibly jive with an exchange of lands, which I believe would be done under the Constitution, in accordance with the Constitution, that then we could timber, mine, and lease. Because once that land is gone, and every farmer at this table knows it, when he sells a quarter of land to make payments that he has to make to stay alive for the next planting season, that is a terminal illness in your financial planning, whether it be in business or in government. I'm trying to take a deep breath. I feel Rukavina coming into my veins. Pardon me. And this is a horrible bill, this particular section. The range delegation, excluding possibly one member at the present time, has fought for 25 years, to my knowledge, to get justice to these school kids by getting the federal government to come forward with a land exchange or a condemnation or something that met the Constitution. But yet in every other land exchange, we have had to, and the land, miles and miles of shoreline on Lake Vermilion have been forced to be traded, which is absolutely useless to us. We aren't, it's most valuable, and look at Lake Vermilion State Park, how valuable that was. We've got miles of trust land, but we don't do anything with it because it's too beautiful to touch. When people get over the fact that that land in the wilderness should belong to the federal government, we should do it in accordance to the Constitution, and then we should mine, log, and lease the hell out of that land that we get in the change. And that's how you get a return. In fact, of the hundreds of millions of dollars that are in those two accounts, the school trust account and the university account, the vast majority, by the power of nine, has come from mining, leasing, and timbering. And a tiny, tiny fraction of it has come from interest. And the day you can make a living for the kids with interest, it'll be the demise of those funds. So my question was, is how does this jive with the Constitution, and how can we possibly have a section in this bill, Representative McFarland, that authorizes a private sale for cash? That just doesn't make any sense to me. Now, I know Mr. Krebs and I have talked about this, and he says, you're not realistic. you don't want to get it done. 25 years ago, I said that I wanted to get this done, and I'm in the House of Representatives for 10 years, and if this gets done in an exchange, it will be my happiest day. So I don't want to hear the argument that I don't want to get it done. But we should do it the right way and not take money for it. And the environmentalist community, they want us to take money for it because they know we're going to log and mine and lease it. That's the problem here. That's who's driving this ship, and it has been for decades. Every time we go to Congress, the same thing happens. So anyway, I'm getting rookabinized now, so I'll back off. So you heard my question.
Ms. Lewis, to the constitutionality of Section 3. If you could identify yourself for the record, I don't think you've spoke yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathy Lewis, Lands and Minerals Division, DNR. The constitutionality question concerns the condemnation of the school trust land. Representative Deal's correct that the Constitution provides that school trust lands can only be sold through public sale. The issue of condemnation of school trust lands has been done in the state for over 100 years. It was actually challenged in the Minnesota Supreme Court in the early 1900s, said condemnation did satisfy the public sale requirements. So what this bill sets up is there's a condemnation done, then the lands would be still state-owned lands, but they would be in the category that the legislature can authorize direct sale, just like the legislature authorizes direct sales of some DNR lands and acquired lands and tax-forfeited lands. As to Voyageurs National Park, we're trying to avoid the history of Voyageurs National Park. Voyageurs National Park, the school trust lands there were recognized by the state. The governor went to the federal Congress and testified about the issue, and the response from the federal government at that time was, well, that's your problem to solve. And so what the state did for Voyageurs National Park is the state condemned the school trust lands, and the taxpayers of Minnesota paid for the school trust lands through bonding for quite a number of years. In this case, we're looking at the school trust land issue as an issue that the federal government should be paying. The Minnesota taxpayers are not the appropriate party to pay, and so this is working through the transaction so that with the condemnation, condemnation action would not be concluded, and the payment would not be made until the payment is coming in from the federal government, so the taxpayers would not pay for the school trust condemnation. But the private sale is an authorized process through legislative approval.
Follow-up, Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's just a fancy way that the kids get nothing. I mean, every single party that's been around here has always said jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, it doesn't matter what party you're in. It's always about jobs. Well, if you want jobs, then you trade the land out for equal value. If you want to have low returns on money that comes through some maturation of twisting language and intents, then you take the money, and you're going to have very little. It's proven. I'd like to know how much money was generated. I'll rephrase that. The Voyageurs thing was a travesty. We condemned our own land and then asked our own people to pay for it, hand it over to the federal government so we could get a national park. I mean, that's the most pitiful thing I've ever heard. We'd be better off to have those lands still in the Capitogama Peninsula and fighting over an exchange like the Constitution really meant. And I will not vote for this bill. I don't know of any ranger that will vote for this bill except for possibly one. This is in our backyard. I represent 100% of the lands in the Boundary Waters and 95% of the lands at Voyageurs National Park. And if I'm reelected in the next election, I'll have all of Voyageurs Park, all of the Boundary Waters, and this is not the right way to go. We used to produce 40 million tons of taconite in the 80s on 15,000 miners. Today we produce the same amount of taconite on 4,500 miners, and you wonder why we don't have any economy. Granted, we're leaner, we're meaner, and we do things cheaper, but we need resources available to put people back to work. And if you take money, any farmer will know that. If you take money, it's only as good as the person that issued it to you. And I don't think that that's very good right now. So that's my opinion. I'm against the bill. I'm against particularly that particular section. I'm for the intent of getting the things traded. But if the Minnesota legislature put their oomph behind it, we could get our federal delegation to do the right thing. But we're so splintered on the idea of mining and logging and leasing that we'll possibly never get there. And if we never get there, that's the way it should be. We have to fight the fight for the next 100 years.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Commissioner Krebs, if I could ask, I know you've been involved in the issue and are well aware of the issue. A lot of the, naturally, a lot of the land in the BWC is riparian. For those of us who have been there, it's a lot of lakeshore. A lot of the federal land that would be exchanged is not lakeshore. A lot of it's just low-grade timberland. Does the federal government have enough land in northern Minnesota to do a land-for-land exchange? I'm assuming there'd be drastically more federal acreage, I hope, than just doing an equal number of acres.
Mr. Chair, you know, when we started into this process, and I have to give a little more history. We started out with two opposing sides. You know, the state of Minnesota through the DNR came in with their criteria that identified about 100,000 acres.
Commissioner Krebs, yes. 100,000 federal acres outside the BWCA?
Yes, that's what the DNR came in with when we started trying to pair up properties that were suitable. The Forest Service came in with about 10,000 acres. Now we're a long ways away, you know, from an agreement on parcels, and we worked through a process of about 6 months to come up with a mutually agreeable with criteria on both from both sides that what the Forest Service would agree to give up and what the state desired and met their criteria, and we came up with the 41,000 acres. Is it perfect? No, it's not perfect. We were, however, I want to reiterate again, we were following the legislative intent that you gave to the committee in 2009, that we could entertain and look at a land and sale option. This is what we come up with. Does the Forest Service have the land? Yes, but they have land that is also restricted. Through their management plan, through other high-value areas, you know, that and these are lands that they want to go and hang on to. I'm not in a position to say that they're shortchanging here or not. The comment was made that that the forest supervisor retired. One of his goals was to get this accomplished before he retired. He got a proposal. You know, we agreed and we got a proposal on the table. And if he was sitting here today, he would tell you that that's about where the Forest Service is going to go. Now, can you force it through legislation to go up? Anything's possible, but I think personally, and Representative Dill and I've had this conversation, and certainly I haven't told Representative Dill that that this is as good as we're going to get. But I think that we brought a viable proposal to the table that is certainly workable, and we can get through. There may be more lands. You know, another supervisor or another, you know, the Forest Service may add some. I don't know that. But until we get into formal negotiations on it, which I won't be a part of, that will be the real end point where we end up. So this is a start.
Thank you, Mr. Krebs. I appreciate that historical analysis. Members, we're going to take some more discussion, but then I think Representative McFarland may ask Representative Fabian to modify his action. Representative Hansen, I've got you next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Krebs, how many acres are in the BWCA? Do you know?
Commissioner Krebs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, of the school trust lands, there's 86,200 plus acres. Within the, and I'm looking at the numbers here, the state through tax forfeited land and university trust land, which is also has some inside the wilderness. You know, the number I see here is 116,000 acres. I'm not sure. That may be the top end. There has been some action by Lake County to exchange their lands out with the Forest Service, and I believe that exchange is nearly complete. Cook County would desire a land exchange. They have about 5,000 acres, something like that, inside the of tax forfeited land, and they desire a land exchange. They would like to go with a land exchange. St. Louis County has about 2,300 acres, you know, and it's isolated parcels throughout, you know, which we would include in a land exchange at some point, if that comes along. It's not right now a high priority for us. But for the school trust, there's about 86,000 acres.
It looks, Representative Hansen, like there's 400,000 acres total in the BWCA. Commissioner Krebs, is that true, or Representative Dill? Looks like Googling quick, that's what they said.
Mr. Chair, I think
Representative
you're
Dill.
Asking how many acres of state.
Yeah, no, how many acres are, how many square miles or acres are in the BWCA, period?
Well, I believe there's, give me a 5% leeway, but my recollection is 1,265,000 acres.
Well, that's
and the
cool.
total, and the, and approximation of federal land in those counties that Mr. Krebs discussed is somewhere around 2.2 million acres. In fact, to that point, Mr. Chairman, just the Mesaba Purchase Unit, which is an area out away from the boundary waters by a long way, most of it is along 53, Highway 53, there's about 93,000 acres, plus or minus, just in the Mesaba Purchase Unit. Those are old homestead. Those are places that went tax forfeit, and the federal government assumed them in some way or another. And, you know, there is a huge amount of land that isn't even near the boundary waters that could be exchanged out where they're already mining, where there's already taconite mines. In the neighborhood, you can see taconite mines from the property, and I mean, I think you know where I'm at. But you know, I've seen many times, Mr. Chairman, in my 10 years here, that the agencies negotiate something with somebody, and then the legislature can come along and do a better deal because we have the force of law. And as I said earlier, if we put our oomph behind this, we could get the right deal for the kids, not a deal that's destined for no return for the part of the cash part. But I hope I answered your question.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. You had the floor, but I think the answer is, I thought you were looking for, there's over 2 million acres in the BWCA, and we're talking about school trust land. Is that true, Representative Dill?
There's about 1,265,000, as I remember, million of BWCA, but then there's about 2.2 million or thereabouts of federal land that's in the Superior National Forest.
Okay.
And that it's from that difference between the, I'm calling it 1.2 million and 2.2 or thereabouts, that we could make the trade that's fully without outside the boundary line.
Thank you, Representative Dill, for that clarification. Back to you, Representative Hansen. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just going to go for rounding here. Let's just call it maybe a million plus of BWCA, and we've got 80 plus of school trust land. And how much do people pay as an entrance permit to the BWCA?
We maybe would have to ask Congressman Paulson, because he's the one that goes there regularly. Now, Representative Dill, I'm embarrassed to say it's been a few years. I don't know what the permits are today to go to the BWCA.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether you're referring to day use permits, camping permits. There's a lot of different permits. It's a reasonable amount. And we receive a payment. I forget, but there's a formula that we get from those permits, and it's a paid back. I frankly can't remember all those details. Now, Representative Rukavina could meet you in the hallway and recite this stuff by rote.
Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's kind of where I'm going. Let's just say they're 10 to 12 or 15 bucks for a day permit, and if you have 8% of the BWCA as school trust land, 250,000 folks may be going to the BWCA $3 million or so, roughly, coming in a year, you could have $200,000 coming in to the trust per year. Maybe my numbers are off, but roughly $200,000 that would come in for use of the school trust lands within the BWCA if the state got its share of use from that, from a permit holder, or you know, maybe that's about a buck surcharge on the, if it's not happening now, if we're owed back payments 5 years, $200,000, you start getting into some money that's relatively serious. So I think, Mr. Chair, this would be something to look at as to what could come in. I know it's not the big money, but it would be something that could be coming in for use of the school trust lands in the BWCA now.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative McFarland, do you have a response?
Yes. That is federal lands, the federal income, and I guess my understanding is a few years ago that the legislature tried to get a fee, part like $3 per person, and it did not go over well with the federal government.
Follow-up, Representative Hansen.
Well, Mr. Chair, times change, and we could either ask for the share through an appropriation and work with our federal delegation to set up that. And Representative Dill indicated there was some formula now, but to try to look at that, or to go back and see if we could add something on to have that come forward. So I think it's worth looking at. Maybe we're achieving it now, but it's some idea that's another way of getting some resources right now for the use that's there on the state-owned lands within the BWCA.
Mr. Chair, I would say that is, Mr. Representative Hansen, that would be something that we could pursue, but it doesn't take the place of what we need to do here.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I would agree it's a different issue, but I think we should, if we're looking to find resources for the kids for the use and the constitutional requirements, it's another venue, and I'd be happy to work with you on this, exploring that.
That sounds great.
Thank you. I was next on the list, and I really just had a comment to make that channeling Representative Rukavina is not in my skill set, but responding to Representative Dill's comments about farmers and the value of land and the importance of retaining your assets in your operation, I couldn't agree more. Turning this land into cash to me is a huge mistake. Keeping this land for the kids and generating income, the unknowns are and assumptions involved in a cash sale are great and many, and the relative value of land and cash is something that none of us can predict. Next on the list, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the predictions have been made about this particular land, and we haven't put that on the table. The assumption is that we will be able to log this forever, and that will be the income that will be for the school children. However, this legislature has heard again and again from the best scientists in the world, which are at the University of Minnesota, and I will particularly mention Dr. Lee Frelick, who tells us that within the lifetime of the children that we're talking about right now, the BWCA is going to change. It will not be growing the same kind of trees it is growing right now. So it is, if you're asking Representative McFarland what I'm talking about with the change in climate, the prediction has been made by the best experts we have that the BWCA will not look like it looks right now, neither will the Superior National Forest. So cash is a good idea here. It is a burden, you know, what is it? A burden hand is worth two in the bush, and this is probably even more important at a time when we're not talking about the particular elephant in the room right now, and that is the huge change in these lands, which will happen within the next 90 years. So to say that 100 years from now we're going to, quote, unquote, log the hell out of it, That may not be possible anymore. So we got to talk about the reality of what's going on in this particular area. And so right now, I think maybe it would be best to have cash in hand. And if we are talking about acting as trustees, when you can have a bird in hand is worth two in the bush, is, I think, what we should be talking about here.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Carlin.
Thank you. First of all, we're not talking about logging in the Boundary Waters.
But we're talking about logging.
But with land, there are other uses other than timber and mineral and leasing. There could be other things. In Texas, they're doing geothermal drilling. I mean, there's a lot of other opportunities out there with land that we really haven't even explored. So I just think I think a hybrid might be best. Would
Representative Dill to this point?
Well, actually, I went up and visited with Mr. Ungaro about Representative Hansen's question. So this goes back a couple of questions. For the Ty Blatnick Act in the 40s or 50s set a system that paid 0.75% to the jurisdictions based on the value of the land, and then every 10 years it's reappraised. And he just informed me that that amounts to about $1.6 million to St. Louis County annually. So there is a payment that's coming from the land. It's similar to PILT. I would classify it similar to that.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dill brought up a very good point that there was condemnation. There were dollars paid in the past. I'd like to find out what happened to those dollars. Did they go to the schools? Did they go to general fund? Did they go to the DNR? And I was wondering if any of the testifiers knows the, you know, details on that.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, when there's a condemnation of school trust land, the payment goes into the corpus of the permanent school fund. So for Voyages National Park that we talked about, the payment went into the corpus of the school fund, and the State Board of Investment manages that fund, and the income and dividends go to the school districts throughout the state.
A follow-up, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be nice to see the particulars of, you know, how much money went in there, how much was used for covering the expense of, you know, the bonding activity, etc. And then if there's some way to show where that money was dispersed from that fund or, you know, stayed in there. I think this is not a trivial or a, you know, day trader type thing. We need to look at past experiences to maybe see what might happen if we did get cash. And that's why I'm just trying to find out some background and history. Thank you.
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to share with the members, I'm really moved by what Representative Dill had to say, and that it appears that if we do a land swap, we're going to, if it's all land swapped, we would have a net reduction of federal land in Minnesota and a net increase of movement towards state ownership, or at least it's closer to individual ownership than we had. But I like the fact that we are reducing federal ownership of land if we go that approach. The notion that we're going to have global warming and have no longer be able to log the hell out of it, I think Representative Dill coined a new term here. But you know, I think we're always going to be able to log it. We may have a different species of trees if you subscribe to global warming. It may move to red oak and, God forbid, black walnut. and Representative Walgenius, about three or four times the value. So the kids will be much better off under that scenario. Thank you.
Representative Draskowski, did I understand your remarks to actually promote the state ownership of land?
Well, there are different forms of government, Mr. Chair, and the government that's closer to the people is the better government. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Baskowski. I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh, yeah.
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, and I was, just to get back to Representative Dill's point, I know we're flipping between points here, but I think the reimbursement that goes to the county is to the county. Rather, what I'm talking about is a use fee that the people pay to go into the BWCA. And when they go into the BWCA, they are enjoying school trust lands. So trying to recover the use fee or to accommodate the use fee that goes in to go to the trust is different than the compensation for the taking of the land from St. Louis County or Cook County or those areas. So that's kind of the, I understand what you're saying, and I went up to Mr. Ongaro as well to kind of clarify that. So I think it's worthwhile to try to deal with the usage of this. Mr. Chair, I did have another question, if possible.
Representative, I'm sorry, I was distracted there for a moment. Mr. Representative Hanson, did you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative McFarland, how do the, let's say we do the exchange and we swap for land, what are all the federal requirements, NEPA and that apply within the BWCA? How do they apply outside of the BWCA? What are the if we swap land out, how's that, what's the umbrella of coverage under federal law?
Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, I'm going to have Kathy Lewis answer that.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members, the under the federal law, the standard federal land exchange process does require NEPA, which is about an 18-month process is estimated for this project, and it would cost about $1 million. In other states, they have had instances for doing these activities where the Congress has passed a law saying the project is accepted from NEPA, and so that was an issue raised in the letter to the congressional delegation. The latest conversation our commissioners had with parties has indicated that we are willing to be participant in the NEPA process. And so then the NEPA process has to be done by the feds before they work through the rest of the exchange process, which has similar characteristics to the state process, where you have evaluation and you have title examination, and then you have a final selection of the lands, and then you go through the approval process.
Representative Hanson, a follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the NEPA process cost is borne by the federal government or the state government?
Mr. Chair, members, the proposal on the table is that it would be split 50-50 between the state and the federal government.
One more follow-up.
One more follow-up. So, Mr. Chair, and I think Mr. Meyer had commented earlier there was $200,000 available in the exchange, but if this is an 18-month process, we're really into the next biennium when there would need to be an appropriation. Would that be correct?
That's right.
Ms. Lewis.
Mr. Chair, members, in our fiscal note, we identified $500,000 for NEPA, and that would be recognized that it would not be occurring in fiscal year 13. So the amendment to the bill would say that would be an issue we would be bringing forward in the next budget. That would be an issue we would be bringing forward in the next biennium budget.
Thank you. I have a Mr. Fay from the Sierra Club listed as a testifier. Would he care to come forward? If you would please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Justin Fay. I'm legislative coordinator for the Sierra Club. I appreciate the opportunity to speak briefly today regarding House File 2207. As you've already heard, this issue has been around for a very long time. Over the years, there have been other proposals and attempts to resolve the issue of trust lands in the BWCA, and we certainly do appreciate that Representative McFarland and the department are trying to move the conversation forward, as this is an issue that does need to be dealt with. From an environmental perspective, we do believe that the best solution would be a full sale of trust lands in the BWCA to the federal government. It's important to remember that there are differences between how national forests can be managed and how school trust lands could be managed. In your packets, you should have a letter that was signed by more than 40 environmental and conservation organizations that outlined several legal protections that apply to national forest land but would not apply to state-managed school trust land. My point in bringing this up is not to suggest that we should never do land exchanges or that federal land management is somehow perfect. Rather, I'm simply trying to make the point that exchanging land in this way is not as easy as simply changing the name of the government entity that, or the government unit that manages it. This is particularly true when one considers the size of the exchange that's being considered here. Earlier testimony was that the exchange would involve approximately 36,000 acres of Superior National Forest land. To put that in some context for you, the city of Minneapolis proper is under 35,000 acres in total. So what we're talking about is actually removing an area of land the size of the city, the state's largest city, out of the national forest system. It's a big deal. I do want to. There was some reference earlier to a working group that has been dealing with potential exchange and looking at candidate parcels. I do just want to make sure you understand that there has not been any formal public process regarding a land exchange along the lines of what's described in this bill. No opportunity thus far for public input regarding the selection of candidate parcels or the appropriateness of particular lands for management by the trust. Regardless of how this issue moves forward, we believe that public involvement and scrutiny is critical. Mr. Chairman, in the interest of time, I'll stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Fay. I don't see any questions. Representative McFarland, any comments as to how we might proceed today?
I have listened very carefully to Representative Dill and other people's concerns, and I would like to lay this on the table. We have a permanent school fund advisory committee this Friday, and we're talking about legislation that we are taking up this year, and I think that it would be good for them to weigh in on this situation again, so that's why I would ask to put it on the table right now, lay it on the table.
Thank you, Representative McFarland. Representative Fabian, would you like to change your motion?
Change our motion to lay this bill over, House File, 2207.
Thank you. We'll lay 2207 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have a question for Representative McFarland, if
go ahead.
That would be appropriate. Representative McFarland, could you refresh my memory on this? What percentage of the total K-12 budget is represented by the amount that is paid to the schools from the trust fund as it's currently structured?
Representative McFarland.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, zero goes into the general fund appropriation for education. It's a special payment that's made to the school districts in addition to their general fund dollars. Right now, it's approximately $26 to $28 per student.
A follow-up, here. Representative Hilty?
And Mr. Chair, and Representative McFarland, I recognize that it doesn't go into the general fund, but do you know or could you find out what percentage of the total expenditure that we make for K-12 is represented by that amount?
Representative Farland, do you have that information offhand?
I don't have that top of my
we'll try and get that information for the members of the committee, and we have other information, I believe, that we are going to be collecting. Any further questions, Representative Hilty?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to. I think that it's important to understand what we're talking about in terms of percentages here. I mean, if we dealt maybe the best case scenario in terms of what return we could get in the management of the school trust lands would be to double what we have right now. Mr. Chair, looking around the table, I think there's only three members that were in the legislature when Representative Pugh was the minority leader and then Representative Tim Pawlenty was the majority leader. And I remember there was sort of maybe more good humor at the time. And there was quite a lot of banter between the majority and the minority leader. And one of the ironies that was typically expressed in that became something that came up with great frequency was, I remember, Representative Pawlenty's saying in support of just about any bill that came up, it's for the children. Remember that, Tom? I think there's maybe a little bit of hypocrisy in the discussion that we're having about the school trust lands, that maybe we should be a little more honest about. If we're really concerned about the children, why don't we just fund education the way we ought to? And let's be honest about what's going on here.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Farland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty. No one is trying to say that this should take the place of the state's obligation to fund education. What we're saying is this is the additional money that we should be able to give our children as we move forward for additional things.
Thank you. House File 2207 is laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Hackbarth, do you want to make a motion on your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I would move that House File 1989 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. And, Madam Chair, I would also move the committee engrossment. I believe those are the proper motions.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. We have
Madam Chair and members, I've got a couple of small technical amendments that I'd like to make to get the bill in the shape, and then I will explain the bill and why it's here. The first one would be an oral amendment. In the Energy Subcommittee, we did make an amendment to change some of these technical words, but we missed one. And on line 1.19, the very last word in that line says electronic. We'd like to delete the word electronic and insert the word electric.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Representative Hackbarth moves an oral amendment on line 1.19, changing the word electronic to electric. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Then there's another amendment that members should have in their packets, the A5 amendment. Madam Chair, this is an amendment that was suggested by you in the Energy Subcommittee, and I think it was moved by Representative Falk. And for some reason, even though it reflects in the minutes of the Energy Subcommittee that this was done, apparently we missed it somehow, and we'd like to make the change here. So I would move the A5 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, members, and thank you, Madam Chair. With that, members, I'll briefly explain in my brief terms, and there's people in the audience that can answer questions. But the reason this bill is here is it's called the Right of First Refusal Bill. It has to do with incumbent electric energy producing companies, utilities, if you will, that have their own territories where they produce electricity, they transmit that electricity in their territory. And the reason this bill is here, it's about building new transmission lines and maintaining those transmission lines. The federal government allowed incumbent power producers to have right of first refusal. They changed their rules or law, if you will, and have now said that it's going to be up to the states to resume or assume this responsibility. And they said that the states should probably put this in statute in their own laws, that they could allow right of first refusal on building and maintaining transmission lines. And that's kind of it in a nutshell. Madam Chair, and I would stand for questions, or we can bring people up that would like to answer those questions.
Thank you, Representative Hackbarth. Is there anyone in the audience wishing to testify about this bill? Any questions for members?
Madam Chair, I think we vented this subject in the Energy Subcommittee quite well, and I think people are on board with passing it on to the General Register.
Okay. Representative Hackbarth renews his motion to pass House File 1989 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, members. The meeting's adjourned.